Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for November 29th, 2016. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and today I'm talking to Bridget Wilson about pre-B-cell receptor signaling in leukemia. B-cells are lymphocytes that protect us by secreting antibodies that bind to pathogens and tag those pathogens for destruction by other cells of the immune system. The B-cell receptor, or BCR, is a multi-protein complex that's unique to B-cells. The BCR controls many aspects of B-cell function, and the precursor of the BCR, the pre-BCR, is also important for B-cell biology. Signaling through the pre-BCR promotes the survival and the proliferation of B-cells, and aberrant pre-BCR signaling can cause B-cell leukemias, which are characterized by an excess of B-cells that don't mature. Wilson and her colleagues looked at how homotypic interactions between pre-BCRs stimulate these receptors and how this type of signaling is important in a type of B-cell leukemia. Wilson spoke to me from the University of New Mexico Health Sciences Center in Albuquerque. Hi, Dr. Wilson. Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to be here.
The pre-B-cell receptor and the B-cell receptor are both important for proper B-cell development and activation. How do these complexes differ, both in terms of structure and in terms of functionality?
Well, it's fascinating. The large variety of antigen binding sites of BCRs and the antibodies that they make are created through recombination of the heavy and light chain genes. And the heavy chain is the first one to be edited. In order to pass the first checkpoint in B-cell development, a membrane form of this newly rearranged heavy chain is synthesized by the cell. This occurs at the endoplasmic reticulum, so it undergoes something called co-translational translocation into the ER. And there it finds the sirtuin chains and the signaling subunits of the BCR. They get together and traffic to the cell surface in order to send a signal that the heavy chain rearrangement has passed go. And this is really a quality control measure. It gives the green light for the next step, which is light chain recombination. So after that, the variable chain of the light chains are recombined, and then they're synthesized, and they replace the surrogate light chain to make a mature BCR. The cell then has to pass another checkpoint, which is a particularly important one because it removes autoreactive immunoglobulins. And this would be seen as a strong signal, and the cell would undergo apoptosis. So the signals at both of these checkpoints have to be just right, not too weak and certainly not too strong.
How is signaling through the pre-BCR involved in B-cell leukemias?
Well, if you think about the early stages of B-cell development, the cells start out depending on survival signals from the IL-7 receptor, which is a JAK-STAT signaling pathway, and then they move on to depending on pre-BCR signaling. This type of leukemia occurs when there's a block in development in these really early steps. Now, many genetic mutations underlie cancer transformation in this disease, and so there are quite a few different subsets that are based on translocations, mutations, and deletions that are commonly seen in the genomes of these leukemia patients. Because this is the most common cancer in children, we and a lot of others are really motivated to figure out which of these subsets are still reliant on the pre-BCR signals, either acting alone or more likely through crosstalk with other oncogenic signals.
The pre-BCR generates constitutive weak signaling, often referred to as tonic signaling. What effect does that tonic signaling have on B-cells?
The unique thing about the pre-BCR is that it can signal in the absence of ligand. When we started on this project, we were really intrigued by some of the seminal work by others, such as Chris Garcia at Stanford and Fritz Melchers at the University of Basel. Their papers all pointed to the lambda-5 part of the surrogate light chain to explain how these interactions might take place. They suggested that dimers and maybe even higher oligomers could happen when the surrogate light chains on adjacent receptors bind each other. And we call these homotypic interactions because they're self-associations. And of course, we're aware that strong signals should set off apoptosis in developing B cells. So we developed the hypothesis that these events must be really short-lived. That's what we set out to test in this paper by using single-particle tracking methods.
What stimulates this weak signaling? Is that signaling just activated by chance when the receptors bump into one another, or is there some sort of stimulus involved?
Well, it's really a matter of timing and density. Imagine that the receptors are diffusing around on the cell, and thus they're undergoing what we call diffusion-mediated reactions. Here's why you may want to look at the videos, because in the videos you can see receptors diffuse around, and you can even see the dimers form and fall apart in real time. And while you're watching, it's important to think a little bit about it, the experimental conditions. So when you're doing single-particle tracking, you put a probe on just a small fraction of the receptors so that you can keep track of individual ones. They're a small fraction of the whole, which is about 10,000 receptors per cell. The other thing to think about is that you can watch the dimers form and fall apart because the lifetimes of these reactions are pretty fast. Another thing to think about the receptor is the valency of the receptor. Because there's two antibody arms, each of the receptors are bivalent. So in theory, they could each make long chains, adding one at each end. And we do see some evidence for aggregates of sizes maybe 3 or 4 in a chain, but these break apart pretty fast. So we think most of the complexes that form are dimers. So now let's move on to signaling. If we assume that only dimers and a few higher order oligomers, 3 or 4, can initiate signaling, then each of these complexes has a pretty short window to engage the downstream kinases. And we're working on approaching this through mathematical modeling. So far, our models predict that at steady state, only about 1 to 2,000 receptors are engaged in dimers and small oligomers. And so the lifetime that these dimers stay together matters because they need next to encounter the signaling molecules, the downstream kinases. For instance, they need to encounter Lin, which will phosphorylate the tyrosine residues in the activation motifs of the signaling subunits. We call these motifs ITAMs, for immunoreceptor tyrosine-based activation motifs. There's two tyrosines in each of the ITAMs. And if both of them are phosphorylated, then you'll get tight binding of the two SH2 domains in the next tyrosine kinase down the cascade, which is SYK tyrosine kinase. And that's the kinase you need to propagate signaling.
You looked at signaling that results from these homotypic interactions of pre-BCRs in the setting of a type of leukemia called B-cell precursor acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or BCP-ALL. How does this type of signaling affect the development or the progression of BCP-ALL?
Marcus Mutian's group at UCSF has also done some really important work in this area. He's shown that it's very easy to tip the balance of kinases and phosphatases that are downstream of the pre-BCR, which results in cell death on either side of the scale, too high, too low. And these important signaling components include Lin, which I mentioned, rephosphorylates the receptor to kick off the signaling cascade in a positive way because that leads to recruitment of SYK tyrosine kinase. Now, Lin is fascinating because it also engages negative regulatory pathways, including phosphatases that remove phosphate from tyrosine residues and from the phosphatidyl inositols. One of these phosphatases that's really interesting, and we follow up in our paper, is SHIP, which is an SH2-containing phosphatase that acts on PIP3. Now, in cancer, we usually associate levels of PIP3 with pro-survival signaling. So it's really interesting that inhibitors of SHIP phosphatase also tip the balance, leading to leukemia cell death. So if you have too strong a signaling, the B cell is programmed at this stage to die.
Is interfering with these homotypic interactions between pre-BCRs a potential strategy for treating BCP-ALL?
I personally like to think that this work is going to lead to new options for treatment. For example, if we can identify the right subsets of patients who would benefit from tyrosine kinase inhibitors, that would really be a win because this is working pretty well in some mature B-cell cancers. our group is particularly pursuing therapeutic antibodies against the circuit light chain. We think this might have an advantage over some of the successful antibody approaches that are already out there, because they currently target and destroy the mature B cells in the patients. Our reasoning is that if we can target the leukemia cells very specifically and avoid the functional mature B cells, the patient could be at less risk from infections during the treatment. Of course, we'll first have to develop methods to screen for the right subset of patients, and we think this is pretty easy to do because there are already good antibodies out there to detect pre-B cell surface expression that are used by hematopathologists across the country. One more thing I should mention is that in parallel, we can learn a lot about these patients from next-gen sequencing. This is happening in laboratories and cancer centers across the country. And in the leukemia case, it can be used to classify patients, particularly the group of high-risk patients that are dependent on tyrosine kinases. It's become pretty easy to spot what are called the gene signatures in these cases because they have similarity to a class of ALL patients that have 922 translocations. Now, the 922 translocation, this gets a little complicated, is sometimes called the Philadelphia chromosome because it leads to expression of the BCR-ABL oncogene. And these patients have pretty poor outcomes. They sometimes respond to ABL tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And so now we have a sort of hook on how to treat patients who have this kind of signature by using tyrosine kinase inhibitors.
Bridget, thanks for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
That was Bridget Wilson talking about a paper from the November 29th issue of Science Signaling by Erasmus and colleagues. You can read that article online at stke.sciencemag.org. The Science Signaling Podcast is a production of Science Signaling and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Advancing science, serving society. If you have any comments or questions, you can write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. I'm Annalisa Van Hook. On behalf of Science Signaling and AAAS, thanks for listening.